Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network. We'd like to thank our sponsor today, Hearst Ranch. Well, today we're excited to have three guests on our show who will talk to us about protecting and promoting sustainable agriculture and ranching. Lisa Hamilton is the author of the new book, Deeply Rooted, Unconventional Farmers in the Age of Agribusiness. Her book profiles three farmers who are succeeding using small-scale and sustainable farming practices. One is an organic dairyman in East Texas named Henry Lewis. Then she writes about a rancher in Abiquiu, New Mexico, and finally an organic vegetable farming family in North Dakota. Then we'll talk with Andrew Gunther, who is the program director for a relatively new program called Animal Welfare Approved. And that's a project of the Animal Welfare Institute. Finally, we'll meet Hugh Fitzsimmons, who is the first Animal Welfare Approved bison rancher in the country and also the first farmer ranch to win this certification in Texas. So we'll be talking with all three of our guests. I'd also like to invite our listeners to write me, just email me at marla@edibleaustin.com. to win a free copy of Lisa Hamilton's book. I've got a book, a copy of Deeply Rooted, that I'd love to give away to somebody. Just tell me in your email about a farmer in your area who's bucking the trend of to get big or get out. And we'll select a winner and also invite your farmer to be a guest on my show. I'll tell you more about this a little later, too. So we're going to take a quick break right now and be back with author Lisa Hamilton. Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network, and this show is brought to you today by Hearst Ranch. Thanks for joining us. Lisa Hamilton is a writer and photographer whose work has been published in National Geographic Traveler, Harper's Magazine, The Nation, Orion, and Gastronomica. She lives in Northern California and is currently touring to promote her new book, Deeply Rooted, Unconventional Farmers in the Age of Agribusiness. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Hi, Marla. It's great to be here.
Thanks. Lisa, your book focuses on three farming families in rural America who are bucking the trend of get big or get out. In writing a book about our food system, why did you decide to focus on these particular farmers, and how did you find them?
Well, that's a great question. They are, as you said, three families. The first is Harry Lewis, who's an African-American dairy farmer in East Texas. The second is Virgil Trujillo. He's a 10th-generation rancher in northern New Mexico. And the third family is the Podals. They're up in North Dakota, sort of in the belly of the beast of industrial corn and soybeans production. And they're really an emblem of how these unconventional farmers are redefining what it means to be a farmer in America today. I found them through my work. As a writer and a photographer, I focus exclusively on food and agriculture, and particularly on the stories of farmers. So over the years, I've met many unconventional farmers. When it came time to write a book, I sort of narrowed down the group of people whose stories had intrigued me over the years, and it was a slow process with a lot of factors, but ultimately what mattered to me most was that these were the three stories that I couldn't not tell, I suppose. Mm-hmm. The characters are so interesting. The stories are, I couldn't make them up, better than fiction. So they're an interesting bunch.
That's great, and they certainly are. I really enjoyed reading the book. Just give us a very brief introduction to each of these three guys or families, and then I'll ask you some more specific questions about them. But just sort
okay.
of give us a little overview that captured your imagination and the passion that you put into writing the book.
I will. You know, I would start by defining what it means to be an unconventional farmer, as mentioned in the title. It's a term that I came up with to, I guess, put into a group the kind of farmer that really draws me in and that I think is important to changing the food system. It's this idea of rejecting the passive role that conventional agriculture has given to farmers. And I explain it, I think, best in my introduction, and I would just take a moment to read a couple lines from the introduction where I explain what it means to be an unconventional farmer. I write, what binds these people is not a particular farming method, but rather the conviction that as humans, the contributions they make are essential. Conventional agriculture doesn't need people for much more than to run the machines and carry the debt. But these people refuse that lifeless role. To the work, they bring their intellects and their consciences, their histories and their concerns for the future. In quiet ways, in quiet places, they have set about correcting the damage that has come from believing agriculture could actually be reduced to numbers alone. The first step, reclaim their place in the center of the equation. And so the book goes on to tell the stories of these three families. Harry Lewis is perhaps the most talkative person I've ever met in my life. He's a real character. We spent a lot of our time together laughing, and I guess the rest of it, me listening to his stories. And, you know, it's hard to encapsulate these stories into just a quick line or two, but what really rises above for me with Harry is that he's, I guess he brings a philosophical approach to this whole conversation about defining what it means to be an organic farmer. He brings it away from regulations and quotas and quantifying, and brings it instead to a sort of philosophical level in his own unique East Texas barbecue and, you know, coleslaw kind of way. Mm-hmm. The second is Virgil Trujillo, and he has sort of a he sort of flips the story of the small farmer to see it from the perspective of the community, and specifically in his case, the community that has kind of given up agriculture. His great struggle is to bring agriculture back into his community as something that can bind it together again. Fascinating story behind him is that, as I said before, he's a 10th generation rancher, descended from, I guess, the history of the Spanish conquest, and he himself is descended from Plains Indians who were slaves of the Spanish, and fascinating history. The third story is the Podols up in North Dakota, and they, perhaps more than anyone, are about redefining what it means to be a farmer. As I said, they're in the midst of corn and soybean country. You know, some of their neighbors have 10,000 acres spread over several counties. Well, in the midst of that, the Podols are, I guess, before anything, gardeners. And the point of their farm, the first priority, is to feed themselves. They then use that sort of the lessons they learn from doing that, the attitudes that they've garnered from doing that, and apply that to the rest of their farm, which is close to 500 acres of grains, primarily grains. So they're a whole new model for what farmers can be, and in my eyes, a really important model given the uncertain future that we're facing with climate change and diminished water resources and the end of cheap energy and so on. So, and that's kind of where the book leaves off.
Right. The thing with David Podol also that I found really interesting is he started off when he was getting trying to justify conventional agriculture in some ways, and instead became a fervent convert to organic farming, and part of diversifying crops and not just growing one thing, but more importantly, just the whole organic method of sustainable farming. And mm-hmm. and that to me is such a challenge, obviously, where he is, and how does he deal with these challenges?
Well, you know, it's such a great story that he tells. Back in the winter of 1974, he, you know, of course, in North Dakota, there's not much farming happening over the winter, so he kind of squirreled himself away in the house with as much literature as he could find about organic agriculture. He was, at the time, you know, as conventional as anyone else around him. He felt like it was a threat to what they were doing, and so he decided to disprove it by reading everything that he could and, you know, systematically checking off all the things that were wrong and so on. In the course of reading all this literature, he ended up proving organic agriculture to himself and subsequently transitioned their entire farm pretty much immediately. And that's, you know, that's been at the root of why their farm is so different in the years since. But, you know, he certainly hasn't gone backwards. They're not using horses or that sort of thing. He hasn't gone backwards technologically, I suppose. But I think one thing that was important to him is that organic agriculture allowed him to return to the definition of a farmer that had existed when he was growing up. He talks about in the 1960s, as he was in high school, watching the transition that happened around him, and he saw, you know, in his father's generation of people sort of redefining what it means to be a farmer and falling prey to this get big or get out mentality. And he talks about greed taking over the countryside. Well, had he stayed in conventional agriculture, he would have had to buy into that philosophy. And being an unconventional farmer, being an organic farmer and going against the grain has allowed him to, you know, not just to not use pesticides or to, and, you know, to have a smaller farm, but really to be the kind of farmer that he wants to be and that he feels is right, and that allows him to prioritize his values and not just, you know, the bottom line.
Well, and also and along the lines of how do they cope with that challenge of, you know, getting big or getting out. In Harry's story, you talk about how he got hooked up with and his association with the Cooperative Regions of Organic Producer Pools, or the crop, and then how the cooperatives that have come to being like this have kind of turned the system upside down. I wonder if you can talk a bit more about this, and you do a good job in the book, but if you can tell our listeners a bit more about this.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's the same thing with crop. It's a cooperative based in Lafarge, Wisconsin. Probably most listeners of Edible Communities Radio would know it best for Organic Valley, which is its most popular brand. It also has a meat brand and some vegetables and eggs and so on. But their milk and their dairy products are the most well-known, and that's what Meharu is a part of specifically. And what was so liberating for Harry in joining CROP, this cooperative of sort of a motley crew of farmers from all over the country that included, you know, Amish and Mennonite farmers from the Wisconsin area, as well as sort of, you know, like young hippie-ish guys from Vermont and ranchers from South Dakota. Suddenly, he was taken out of a relatively small community of farmers that he had lived in for his whole life and that his father and his grandparents had lived in for their whole lives before him, and suddenly found himself allied with people all over the country, many people who he had never met before. So it's kind of an odd experience for him, but there was this incredible liberation because it was this joining of farmers who said, we're not going to, follow what conventional dairy says we have to do with our farms, especially in the case of Texas. That means move west, multiply your herd by 10 and go up to, 1,000 or 5,000 cows, and put them all on a dry lot and truck in alfalfa and corn for them to eat. It's really important to Harry philosophically and also financially to keep his dairy exactly the way it is, which is based on pasture and based on sort of available means. He's never bought into this idea of capitalization and increasing the herd and increasing the facilities and so on. So financially, it's been wonderful for him to, it was wonderful for him to join that cooperative and find a group of like-minded people who are building a business around, keeping it real. But right. I think even more so, it was liberating for him philosophically because here was a group of other dairy farmers who were saying, we're going to resist this. Just like David Podall, because we feel so deep within ourselves that this is the right way to do it.
Well, and part of that is that they set their own prices as opposed to being controlled like the more commodity distribution system for commodities like milk and grains and things like that. They actually set their prices and control that part of the distribution.
Yeah, that's a critical part of changing the way that the system works. You know, it's one thing to do it at the farmer's market. That's a model that works on a smaller scale. But for something like dairy, that it really is now a national and at times an international commodity, to kind of take back the power of pricing within that system is a very significant act. This cooperative, people joke that they're this cooperative that was started by a bunch of hippies in Wisconsin. But the truth is they're a major force in the organic dairy industry today. In fact, it was at least a couple years ago, they were supplying the majority of organic dairy products in the country, both under their label and under private label, and selling to Stonyfield and so on.
So it's quite significant
what they've done.
Yeah, it's a really good thing to have watched happen, and I hope there can
Absolutely.
Be more of that going on in different areas of agriculture as well. Lisa, one of my favorite quotes in your book is when you asked Harry if he moved back to the farm to save the family farm, and he said no, that he moved back because he needed to be saved, and only the farm could do it. Can you talk a little bit about this and how it relates to what's bringing people back to small family farming?
Yeah, it was such an interesting conversation for me because, coming from the city and assuming all these things about, or knowing all these things about the way that the dairy industry was working, all of these smaller farms shutting down, I just presumed that the reason that Harry moved back from Houston, where he had been living for about 10 years as a younger man, his 20s into his 30s, I just assumed that it was because, he was the young son and he wanted to see the farm continue, and that it needed him in order to save it financially. Well, the truth was that he had gone to the city searching for something, some new sort of meaning in his life or experience, and he told me he never felt quite right there. And looking up at the night sky, he said instead of seeing stars as he had for his whole life, he would see neon lights, and it never quite felt right to him. So he went back to the farm to kind of correct some of the damage that he had done to himself and some of the wrong paths that he had taken while he was in the city. And it was immediately clear to him that that was the place that made sense for him, you know, both because of the lifestyle of a less complicated, perhaps healthier lifestyle than he was living in the city, but also because he was connected there. There was a whole history of his family going back to just after the Civil War when they were recently freed from slavery and kind of for the first time being free men working for themselves, free men and women working for themselves. Suddenly he was back there and able to continue that history and tradition and try to pass it along to his own son. And the meaning that he found in that was tremendous. He hadn't, you know, he'd always kind of thought of the farming life as being something that was restrictive and limiting. And in fact, when he went back, he found that it was a source of freedom. And I think that's something that's happening with a lot of the young people who are getting into farming now, particularly those who are coming from a non-farming background. They, you know, they're breaking away from that conventional idea that to be a farmer is necessarily some sort of loss. And they're saying, actually, there is a whole new sense of freedom and reward in being a farmer. And the central part of what makes that possible is this idea of sort of redefining what it means to be a farmer. You don't see young people from the cities going out and buying, you know, 800 or 2,000 acres of corn and soybeans and running a combine all day. What people are drawn to is relationships with land and with people, with plants and animals, and they're finding that, in fact, farming is can be a really great opportunity for that.
Well, and Lisa, I want to thank you so much for being that inspiration with your book to people. When you cannot read this book and not really get that sense of how meaningful farming can be and what it can do to save people's souls and also to help us save the planet. So it's been a very important book, and I want to just ask you to very briefly let us know what you're up to. I know you're on a book tour, and you have some events coming up in New York City. If you could just tell us a little bit about that, and then I'm going to be giving away a copy of your book. So.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful, yeah, I will
to
be
our listeners,
here.
So stay tuned for how to get a copy of Lisa's book, other than all of you should go out and buy it, but someone will get a free one from us. But Lisa, just tell us what you're up to.
Yes, next week in New York, we're having two events on September 29th at 5:30. We're having a reading and a sort of hors d'oeuvres and wine program at Savoy Restaurant in Soho. And then there will also that will also include a conversation with Annie Novak from Rooftop Farms in Brooklyn, certainly an unconventional farmer in her own right. And then the next night on September 30th, Wednesday, we have a great panel happening at McNally Jackson Bookstore, also in Soho, actually, just down the street from Savoy. And that will be me with Fred Kirschenman and the New York Times' Verlin Klinkenborg. He's the man who writes The Rural Life in the editorial page, among other great things that he does. And then Mary Howell Martins, who is a wonderful farmer up in the Finger Lakes region of New York in Penn Yan, a really interesting grain and vegetable farmer. And the panel will be on the same idea of the changing role of farmers in American society. And we're really looking forward to it. There is information about that on my website, which is lisamhamilton.com.
So all of you in the New York area, please take advantage of this opportunity to go to Savoy on the 29th and the bookstore on the 30th, and go out and get copies of Lisa's book, and she'll sign them for you at those events, I'm sure. It just sounds fantastic. So thanks again, Lisa, for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Marla.
Great. So, okay, so if you'd like to win a copy of Lisa's book from our Edible Community Show, please email me, Marla, at edibleaustin.com,
And tell me about a farmer in your area who's bucking the trend of get big or get out. And perhaps, you know, we can have them as a guest on a future show. So please send, again, your email to marla@edibleaustin.com. So we're going to take a short break here and be back with our next guest.
I woke up this morning, looked out my door. I could tell my milk cow, I could tell by the way she lowed. If you see my milk cow, please drive that old heifer home. Put it low and dry. Cause I ain't had no milk and butter. Since that old milk cow been gone. You gotta treat me right, honey, day by day. Get out your little prayer book, get out on your knees and pray. Cause you're gonna need my help one of these days. You're going to be sorry.
Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network, and the show today is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. Thanks for joining us. With us now is Animal Welfare Approved Program Director, Andrew Gunther. Andrew joined the Animal Welfare Approved Program in April of 2008. Previously, he was the Senior Global Animal Compassionate Product Procurement and Development Specialist for Whole Foods Market. That's quite the title there. Leading the team that designed and launched the company's five-step welfare program in the United Kingdom. Before that, Andrew pioneered the world's first organic poultry hatchery for chickens and then for ducks. The Gunther family also managed the production for the largest independent organic chicken producer in the United Kingdom. And Andrew is currently part of the Texas State Board of Agriculture's Organic Advisory Board and a member of the American Association of Agricultural Scientists. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Marla, hi. How are you?
We're very good here. Thank you. Andrew, could you please give us a little history and overview of what the Animal Welfare Institute is and then how the Animal Welfare Approved Program came about?
Of course, of course. First of all, thank you for what you do and promoting local food and alternative meat production. It's an absolutely fantastic mission, and it's a real privilege to be part of this. The Animal Welfare Approved seal was developed in response to a need for transparency in labeling and marketing of meat to ensure a point of difference between what is sometimes a misleading series of claims made, particularly by the intensive industry, to meet with some consumers' expectations. We come from roots way, way back when, in 1957, in fact, when the Animal Welfare Institute was first put together with the idea of decreasing the sum total of suffering enforced on animals by humans, and pretty much focused on lab animals, animal traps, all of those sort of areas of animal protection. And AWI is not a rights organization in the way that we might know organizations that come from the point of ceasing the end of meat eating, as it were. They're an organization that looks at the best way to reduce suffering. And it was fairly natural then, as time went by in the late 80s and early 90s, that they looked at farm animals and how they could promote farmers, American family farmers, because we're a family farmer organization. In order to carry our seal, you have to be a family farmer, or the product has to come from a family farm, which means it's owned by or operated by American families who have an investment in that program. And then more recently, as we've moved forward, we've become fairly much an independent group under the umbrella of AWI, where we've overhauled the standards, we've overhauled the website, and we've got significant resources to support individual farmers, telling the consumer how great they are.
Okay, and Andrew, how does this program differ from, you started to say a little bit about this, but how does it differ from other certification programs?
There's a couple of unique differences. Number one, obviously, is we're free. We're free to the farmers. Number two is that all of our premise is that animals have a natural predisposition or are programmed to live in an outdoor pastured environment whenever the weather is permissive. We don't say that a cow needs to be outside in 60 below because naturally it wouldn't be outside in 60 below. It'd be in a woodland keeping itself warm and dry. So we're the only USDA-approved welfare program that requires pasture access or forage area access, because we recognize that chickens and pigs didn't generally live in the middle of a field and will normally, root and forage on the borders. Galeas galeas, which is the origin of the chicken, is basically a jungle fowl that eked out a living on the edge of its forest, although we have genetically modified it to the point that we have the industrial birds today that probably don't resemble the origins of the jungle fowl. And it's the same with hogs. They're a woodland animal predominantly. So we encourage people to have foraging areas, but they must have outdoor access. The other one is that we are transparent. We are the only organization where it's possible to get all of your information, everything you need to know about us, on the website. You can look back through our links. You can see into the organization's, AWI's, history, and you can see all of our standards and everything online for free without having to submit a password or your name and address. So we're truly transparent.
Okay, and also, can you talk a little bit about what, I know you travel a lot to visit farms that apply for this program. How does a farm go about applying for the program? And besides being family-run and, obviously access to pasture, are there other requirements to apply for this seal?
Absolutely. I mean, the first thing we would encourage a farmer to do, because the website's now just been revamped, and it's not divided deliberately to confuse one or the other, but we have an area more particularly for consumers, and we have an area more particularly for farmers. We encourage people to go into both, but if a farmer goes into the farmer area, they can see where the standards are published and look through the standards and compare it with their own farming practice. We don't allow mutilations. We don't allow beak trimming in chickens and turkeys. We don't allow tail docking. We require that sows can build nests. But a good farmer will, it's the general rule, almost always pass through our standards, because a good farmer always has at the core of their practice the health and welfare of the animal. They fill out an application form that gets submitted. One of our auditors will take a look at them, give them a call back and talk through the standards, talk through the visit, and then every farm that's in our program has to have a full audit, so the auditor will fly down and review the farm and the standards with the farmer. At the end of the day, the farmer will know if our auditor is going to recommend them for approval. The audit comes back in and goes in front of the standards board with the auditor's recommendation, and subject to everything being okay, they're accepted into the program. And we repeat that process annually.
So every farm gets visited once a year once they're in the program?
They do.
And how is this all marketed to consumers then? Is it up to the farmers themselves to do that, or do you help them with that? Is there a demand for this in retail?
It's a very, very interesting point. I think at all levels, I think the consumer, the informed consumer, is absolutely demanding that animals are treated humanely and the environment's respected when the food they eat is being consumed. What we do is, when a farmer comes on board, we'll issue a press release into the local paper, and I know you're going to talk to Hugh in a minute, and he was one of the first bison producers I met when I came to the United States 5 years ago, and subsequently the first bison producer we've ever certified in the United States. We would put a press release out into the local paper and the local radio and television. Sometimes that gets press, sometimes it doesn't. We supply a pack to the farmer with brochures, with seals for them to use at farmers' markets. We have an ability to support a farmer getting a USDA-approved label claim on their meat, which is quite a daunting prospect if you've never done it before. In respect to USDA, it's actually relatively simple. But if you haven't done it, the amount of paperwork and bureaucracy that involved can be quite daunting. We'll supply you with a website support, building a website if you need to. We're just doing a series of works in our newsletter about using Facebook and Twitter, which at the grand old age with grey hairs I am, I never thought I'd ever use the phrase Facebook and Twitter, but apparently it's amazingly good for getting your message to your consumers, because it's important that the consumer understands why you're different. And our seal gives you the ability to demonstrate why you are different.
And are you finding much support, as back to the question, of in like major retail stores for do they help market this as well? Are they looking for this product now due to consumer demand? And are they encouraging people to go through the program or get involved with the program at all? Do you know?
We've just started having groups of farmers pointed at us as a seal that some of the retailers would prefer the farmer had to differentiate themselves in the store. And quietly, we're working with a number of retailers to bring products to store. The difficulty is that some of these retailers don't want anybody to know about it until the product launches, because obviously it's got a competitive advantage. But I think in answer to your question, yes, retailers are beginning to demand transparency on their product.
So if a consumer wants to help influence your program or help grow your program and support it, can they go to their retail stores and say, I'd like to see more of this seal on more products? And what are other ways, too, that they might be able to support you?
Well, there's a couple of things I would really, really encourage consumers to do. Number one, get on our website, which is www.animalwelfareapproved.org. Have a route round. Sign up for, we do e-blasts, which once a month, we, for instance, last month, Bill Talapan, a very, very, very good chef in New York City, with the American grass-fed Dr. Patricia Wisnett, did a recipe for burgers using grass-fed beef, and we tried them at home, and they were absolutely delicious. So sign up for the e-blast. That'll get you informed as to what's going on, and we try to keep everybody informed of what everybody's doing. So we have e-blast once a month. We blog, and again, it's a very unusual way of communicating for me, but I found it to be exceptionally useful. We do two blogs. We talk about what the program's up to, and we talk about what the industry's up to in terms of the USDA have just announced that you might be able to sell product across state lines from a state-registered slaughter plant. So we try and help our farmers understand some of the rule changes. But as importantly, I think, is just keep asking for it. You know, just we have a slogan, which is your food animal welfare approved? And if you keep asking the question, the retailers will respond. The retailers respond to the dollar. So the more the consumer says, is this high welfare meat? Does this meat come from an American farm? I mean, that's critical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in this global market, you know, we want our meat to come from America. So it's absolutely critical that we say, you know, is this American beef? Is this American chicken? Because it's important that we keep the dollar back in America. Rural America is struggling the same as urban America right now in the recession. And every dollar the consumer spends, we really want to go back to American farmers and direct to the farmers, not to the big corporate monoliths and the big agribusinesses. You know, Smithfield has to make money for its shareholders. So a part of every dollar you spend on a Smithfield pork product goes to shareholders. It doesn't go back to the farmer.
Right.
And if we buy consciously, if we look at what we're eating, we can begin to make a difference to American farming and make the American countryside the countryside it used to be that we all remember. And it's difficult because I wasn't born here, but I've spoken to a lot of farmers who say this is what it was like 30 years ago when the farmer was the center of the community. You know, and sadly, every day, hundreds of people leave farming because they can't make it pay anymore.
So it really is up to us to create that sense of value for the small family farmers in particular, and to go to our retail outlets and, well, first of all, to support them in farmers markets, of course, and CSA programs. But beyond that, especially with a certification program like you have, to go to the larger retail stores and demand that they pay mm-hmm. attention to that.
I think that's such a great cause, Marlon. I think one of the things that the Edible group of magazines and things like Heritage Radio do so well is to help the consumer understand what they can do to make a difference, because I think if we get together as a group, the dollar is going to be the driver. So I would encourage everybody to just keep asking the questions. Is it American? Is it animal welfare approved? Is it what it's supposed to be? Is the label on the outside, in fact, truthful and honest?
Mm-hmm. So you can go to www.animalwelfareapproved.org, sign up for the newsletter. It's very well written and has a ton of information in it. Go encourage the blog by commenting on it, and definitely stay connected to this new certification program that I think is very exciting. So thank you, Andrew, so much for spending some time with us.
Can I just add to that a little bit, Marla?
Pardon me?
Can I just add to that just a little bit?
You absolutely may.
Just go and buy the farmer's meat.
Yes.
As well.
Yes.
You know, if you see Hughes Bison with an AWA seal on it, make sure that's the bison you bought. It might be, you know, a little bit slightly more expensive. A lot of Hughes Bison is the same price.
But it's a better value than any other bison that's out there without the seal. So you know that you're getting something that was raised humanely and good quality, good nutrition,
mm-hmm.
better for you in the long run. So it's a much better value no matter what the price point may say.
Much appreciated.
So thanks again, Andrew. Again, everybody go check it out, and we'll be back in a moment with Hugh Fitzsimmons.
Give me a home where the buffalo roam, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day.
Home, home on the range, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day. How often at night, when the heavens are bright with the light of the glittering stars, have I stood there amazed and asked as I...
Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network, and our show today is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. Our next guest, Hugh Fitzsimmons, is the owner of Thunderheart Bison, and he hosts around 400 or so bison on his 13,000 acres of ranch land in the very southern tip of Texas. And I visited his ranch to witness a field harvest for a story we did about him for Edible Austin about a year or so ago called Honoring the Animal. And I just got back from a second visit to see the on-site abattoir that he has built on the ranch to do preliminary on-site processing. His product, his Thunderheart Bison product, was the winner of the Outstanding Meat and Charcuterie category, as well as the All Artisanal category in the 2007 Gallo Gold Medal Awards. And as you have heard, if you've been listening to my show, he is the first bison rancher in the United States and the first farmer ranch in Texas to be certified animal welfare approved. Welcome to the show, Hugh.
Oh, thank you, Marla.
Glad to have you. Well, first of all, I want to ask you how you got involved in ranching bison in the first place.
I think the reason that I chose bison was I wanted an animal that was indigenous to the area of Texas where the ranch is. We're about 8 miles east of the Rio Grande River, roughly 2.5 hours southwest of San Antonio in what's known as the brush country. And I was doing some research on bison and found that the last native bison was killed in Dimmit County, Texas, which is our county, in 1781. And that prompted me to want to reintroduce them because I wanted an animal that was indigenous and took care of itself and knew the land and was really a part of it. So that's why I chose bison.
And when you first started bringing the bison to the ranch, what was your approach to how you created the meat product from them, and has that changed over time?
Yes, because when I bought the animals, it was 1999, and they'd experienced a tremendous run-up due to the fact that people were buying them, not really to ranch them. Some people were, of course, but a lot of it became sort of a fad, so the price went way up. And within 8 months of the last animal that I purchased, the bison lost roughly 80% of its live animal value. And I had been prepared to go into a cow-calf operation and just sell the calves every year. Well, the first thing I knew, people were turning them loose on the highway all over the United States, and you couldn't give one away. So I went into the meat business and decided that that was the way to go if I was going to stick this out and make it work. So I went into the meat business because I had to, but I'm very glad that I did because it's been rewarding in many different ways.
And can you talk a little bit about what field harvest means and why you
Sure.
you do that with your herds?
Yes, I do field harvesting, and what that means is that we actually shoot the animal in the field under the direction of a Texas health inspector who makes an on-site visit to the ranch and witnesses each and every kill. And the reason that I do that is to eliminate stress through field harvesting because transportation of a bovine, whether it be a cow or a bison, is very, very stressful on the animal. And then the actual killing process at a slaughterhouse is also very stressful. I think a lot of advancement has taken place in the past 10 or 15 years with people like Temple Grandin who've made enormous strides in reducing the stress, but I wanted to eliminate the stress, and that's why I do it the way that I do.
And kind of just hand-in-hand with that, can you describe a little bit about bison culture, or how do these animals, how do they form their family units and live their lives? I know on your ranch, they're really living the life they used to live, very much the way
exactly,
that they're
yeah,
born to be. So can you describe what their animal structure is?
Yes. Well, the social unit, they're very, very social animals, and they live in, I guess, cells or pods is the best way to describe them, but everyone is related. And so you have uncles, brothers, sisters, aunts, grandfathers, everyone is in a unit, and as long as you keep the unit intact, you have the social structure that allows the animal to have security. And where people have gotten in trouble with bison is when they raise either single sex or they'll raise just one age group, and unfortunately what happens then is that there are no role models. So as long as you have role models, bulls for, of course, breeding and herd security, and cows, which are actually the dominant animal in terms of telling the others what to do and when to do it and how to do it, they are a matriarchal society. So that's why I elected to do it that way. And then I will select carefully the 2 and 3 year old younger bulls and the 2 year old and 2.5 year old heifers that haven't bred. And those are the ones that we field harvest.
So you're basically leaving the whole social structure intact. And
exactly.
I think what people don't understand, I know that there is more and more education about why bison or any wild game meat is a healthier product for you than any industrialized product could be. But more importantly, there's a lot of bison being raised in this country along the standards of industrialized cattle production, and is not the same as what you're
yeah.
doing. And I just again want to reinforce that
right.
That it's a very different product if you're eating the bison from your ranch or from a mass produced bison ranch. And
right, they actually feedlot most bison in this country, and they're fed corn. And that's to cut corners so they can get them nice and fat, and then you get nice and fat when you eat that meat. But if you eat grass-fed, you're eating a product that is high in selenium, beta-carotene, taurine. The liver has, I think, one of the highest known concentrations of CoQ10. So there's a reason that the Native Americans did as well as they did pre-contact, pre-European contact in this country. And that's because they had a food source on the plains anyway that was second to none.
Right. And so, again, along the lines of how to deal with your product in particular, can you talk a little bit about cooking techniques and why grass-fed meat in general, and bison specifically, has a certain way that it should be cooked?
Yes. Well, I can address that. It's not something that I know a great deal about, but after 10 years of cooking, I guess I'm somewhat qualified, but the main thing is just low and slow. You want to cook that meat the way that the animal lives its life, low and slow. Just take your time with it. Reduce the heat, of course, and if you're doing a stew or if you're doing something like short ribs, which are just amazing, they're one of my favorite new things to do, the short ribs, and you just want to reduce the temperature but increase the cooking time. So, for instance, if you had a Dutch oven, you put the short ribs in a Dutch oven and then place them in the oven around 200 degrees and whatever liquid you want to put in there with them and let it go for a good 12 to 13 hours overnight. So that's the traditional way to cook a tougher cut of meat. The tenderloin, New York strip ribeye, you can cook pretty much like beef. But you do want to be careful as far as the temperature and the time.
And who buys your meat mostly? Are you selling directly to chefs and restaurants?
We're in, I believe it's up to 22 different restaurants now in Austin and in San Antonio. We've shipped as far away as New York. We're in three different grocery stores in Austin, in San Antonio, and of course we do our farmers markets, which is my favorite thing to do because I get to meet the people and shake hands and answer questions, and I thoroughly enjoy that. So it's just been quite a journey, but it's been a good one.
Well, another thing that I'm struck by with what you do is that you don't just raise meat. You use all parts of the animal, and can you talk a little bit about why you do that and what that means and what products?
About 4 years ago, we decided to go into the leather business and to utilize the hides because the hides are just completely unique. It's the finest leather in the world. It's so supple and yet so strong. The British actually exported bison hides from the United States back to Great Britain to use as the belts on the steam engines that drove the Industrial Revolution. That's where the term belt grade comes from. And the reason that they chose bison was that there's 19 times the number of hair follicles per square inch on a bison hide as there is on a beef cow. Hmm. So you get something that's very, very strong, but it is just almost indestructible. It will last forever. So when I saw how great this leather was, I couldn't pass it up, and I wanted to utilize the entire animal. So that's why we went into the leather business, and our next step is if we can figure out how to gather it all in the springtime is to get the wool, the undercoat of the wool, because the wool is just the most unusual and soft, beautiful textured fiber. So that's our next step after the leather business.
And is your daughter helping you with that? I know she's a textile artist.
She is. It was her senior project in college. She incorporated bison wool into her art project, and it was just fantastic. It was very gratifying to see. It was amazing to see that take place.
Well, Hugh, how can people connect with your products, especially these leather products and the meat products?
Well, we have a website, thunderheartbison.com, and that's probably the best way to get in touch with us. So that's That's probably the most effective way.
Unless you're lucky enough to live in near the farmer's markets where he
is
in person and meeting him in person.
Absolutely. Come see me at the farmer's market. And I think what sets us apart is the fact that we, from the very beginning, recognize that this is a sacred animal that we're dealing with. And it has a tremendous history that is second to none, really, in this country. And an animal that is sacred to the native peoples of this country, I wanted to continue that tradition. And I'm not an Indian, but I'm trying my very best to honor this animal and to provide a life and also a death for this animal that is not tragic, but that has dignity. And to me, that's what's really important, because it's not just how an animal lives, but it's how it dies also that is important. And so when you eat this meat, a lot of people really respond to it in such a way that is gratifying to me, because they understand what's going on here, and that's what I'm trying to achieve.
Well, and I think that's clearly why you've been animal welfare approved as well. And just a last quick question about that. I wondered, how did you find out about the program? And it's very exciting that you've been certified and one of the first to be. What can you say about this program to encourage others to get involved?
It meant so much to me, because it's like finally there's an organization that recognizes and understands what it is that we're trying to do, and it's just so, I was just overwhelmed. But I found out about them through the American Grass-Fed Association, because we're certified grass-fed also, and we have to meet all the grass-fed standards. And then I found out about animal welfare through the grass-fed people.
I see. So again, if you want to go to animalwelfareapproved.org, you can find out more about the Animal Welfare Program, and thunderheartbison.com to connect with Hugh Fitzsimmons and the Thunderheart Bison. Hugh, thank you so much for being on our show. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Marla. I appreciate what you're doing, because it's important. We want to get the word out and get it out for the right reasons.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So thanks to all our guests today, and thank you all for listening to Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network. We'd like to thank our sponsor once again, Hearst Ranch, for making this show possible. I'm going to be back on October 12th, and we'll announce the winner of Lisa's book contest. Again, I'm encouraging you all to email me at marla@edibleaustin.com and tell me about a farmer or rancher in your area that you think is making a difference, and then we will invite the winner of that on our show. So, and then the winner of the recommendation will get the book. So tune in every Monday to the Edible Community Show here on Heritage Radio Network, and we'll see you next time.